Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
So we're going to do immigration today because, holy cow, the news. The way we're going to do it is basically to talk about how we got to where we are from whence we came. Because it's complicated, it's legalistic. No offense to the lawyer on the line. I apologize for that, Kathleen. Kathleen Gasparian, she's an immigration attorney, and we're going to hear from her later, and she's listening at the moment. But we need to sort of unpack a little bit of how we got here. I think that's our value add to this thing. So that is what we're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to take a step back from everything you're hearing in the news today, which is sort of like, okay, we have now gotten to the most extreme, you know, or among the most extreme solutions to a problem that, at a minimum, the last three presidents have tried to deal with. And so hopefully Kathleen can shed some context. We will hear comments and insights from you. But before that, it will be fixation time.
All right. Who's going first? Toss coin? Draw straws? What do you want to
do? Toss a coin.
All right. Wait, hang on. What do you want? Heads or tails?
I always choose tails.
Do you really? How come?
Yep. I don't know.
That's so funny, actually, because I always choose heads, but that's whatever. That's a little relationship insight.
How meta.
Right there, huh?
There we are again. No,
totally. The yin and the yang of whatever this podcast is in a coin toss.
Boom.
There you go. All right. It was tails, so you get to decide who goes first.
See? That's why I always pick
no,
tails.
That's not the way it works. Oh, my God.
Oh,
that's
absolutely
not the way it works.
It absolutely is. America is transfixed right now by the conversations about immigration. There are lots of yeah, other things that nerds like me are fixated on, and that's where I'm going with this.
Okay.
I am fixated on the fact that the European Union tomorrow, June 20th, is going to vote on, you know, we've been talking about the GDPR, like, yay, guys on the white horses coming to, you know, potentially save our privacy. On the other hand, the UK, the EU, rather, is set to vote on a new set of copyright rules, if you will, regulations. And they include, like, some of them are okay. But they include this thing called Article 13, a new copyright law that would essentially undo, you know, I think we've talked on this show before about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, the one that says you, the website, are not necessarily liable for content that appears on your website.
Okay.
Therein, we get Facebook, we get Google, we get Twitter, because they don't have get sued every time a copyright is violated. So Article 13 of the proposed EU copyright directive would just undo all of that. Be like, if you're Facebook or Google, you have to develop new technology to be able to scan everything that is uploaded to your website for copyright violations. And if you don't do it, you will be held liable for everything that gets posted. It is being described as a meme killer.
Oh, because all those GIFs and stuff that are meme worthy are copyrighted, probably, right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially every meme is a copyright violation. And so so Wired UK is calling it the meme killer. Not to mention, of course, just upending the way that the web has worked and has built. In fact,
so is it going to pass?
I don't know. I mean, they're voting on the 20th. The kind of founding fathers of the internet, including Tim Wu, who we've had on the show, and many, many others, Vint Cerf, Jimmy Wales, Brewster Kahle from the Internet Archive, have all written this letter saying, like, if you ask internet platforms to do automatic filtering, you essentially take the internet from being an open platform into a tool for, quote, automated surveillance and control of its users. And in fact, ahead of this vote, YouTube's already, like, censoring some content.
So not to get too far down this rabbit hole, because, you know, it's not a forever podcast. How much of this is a logical outgrowth of GDPR and the whole European Union regulators wanting to regulate these kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so this is, you know, this is not directly tied to GDPR, but the reason that GDPR exists is because the European Union, philosophically has said social media, these big internet companies, they are running roughshod over the world and our culture, and they're trying to get it in line. And frankly, you have U.S. lawmakers starting to chip away at Section 230, starting to say maybe this protection for these big platforms isn't such a good idea. What's really interesting is I know one guy who's a VP of product at a local startup, and he said, look, between this if this passes, and maybe even the copyright directive in general, because other than this one article, it's very, you know, it's much broader. People, he said, people are just going to say it's not worth it in Europe. Right. Like, it's our startup isn't going to expand there. But I will say, and then I will be done fixating, that on the other hand, Theresa May over in Britain, with Brexit looming, has been like rolling out the red carpet to the tech industry.
Well, she's desperate, right?
They're desperate. Yeah. But like, let's say that GDPR is too punitive for people, or that Article 13 actually passes, and companies say, we're not, I'm just, right?
I know where you're going. And the Brits are out from under the EU, you know, choking regulations, or so the pro-Brexiters say. And this, well, there you go, right?
And it's not like the Brits have been known for being, you know, regulation-free.
No.
They're all about the surveillance. Yeah. But it would be so interesting if the transformation was for the Brits to say, like, come live in our, like, sovereign tech utopia.
That's some unintended consequences right there. Wow.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. Fixation. That's good. That's good. All right. So mine was going to be Incredibles 2, but it's not, because I did a movie last time, I think. I want to talk about Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce. And this whole thing that's getting buried. This, in any other administration, this would be a blow you out of the water scandal. But here you have Wilbur Ross, a billionaire, or so he says, who had a huge long list of investments that he was supposed to divest of in accordance with government ethics policy. And he said he did. And then Forbes started asking some questions about an investment that he had that was linked to a Kremlin-linked shipping company. Forbes asks Ross questions about this. Ross, like the next day, shorts the company, right? Bets that the stock is going to go down. Then the story comes out, and he sells the stock. It's unbelievable. Would be blow you out of the water scandalous. But as with so much present day, it is buried by, the present day.
Ross appears, I'm looking this up because Kai doesn't tell me in advance. Ross appears to have broken one law. Submitting a sworn statement to federal officials in November, this is according to the nationalreview.com, saying he divested of everything he had promised that he would.
Right?
You know,
I mean, it's amazing.
I want to, this seems like a good time to return to last week's conversation, because I think there was a lot of conversation about our conversation last week about discourse and, you know, the sober pursuit of information in the face of propaganda and how you should respond to it. And it's been great. And I've had some knockdowns with friends of mine in a good way about what is appropriate. What is the appropriate way to respond? And I said this on Twitter, and I'm going to say it again here, which is like, good job, Forbes. And good job, everybody who has gone to Texas to do the work and take the photos. You know, if you look at the front page of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and every headline has Trump in it, that's not quite right. That says we're selling papers on the backs of this name. And what we really need to do is the sober, hard work, boots on the ground journalism of like telling every one of these stories. Telling every one of them. And then let, you know, make the truth inescapable. And hopefully it will win. That's my like impassioned defense of journalism today.
Which is a good one. I have
the good kind.
The good kind. The good kind. All right. Anyway, so tell us what you're fixated about, whether it's the state of journalism or Incredibles 2 or Wilbur Ross or the meme killer. You know, make me smart at marketplace.org. You can tweet us at Kai Rizdahl, at Molly Wood. There you go.
There you go. I'm down the Wilbur Ross rabbit hole now.
I know. It's crazy. It's amazing, actually.
This is not normal.
Music.
Back to the beginning. This music is my jangled nerves in a nutshell. Jangled nerves.
Fire it up.
The treble. Okay. All right. Immigration. Pressure, obviously, mounting on immigration policy. And that has been the cornerstone of the Trump administration and campaign since the campaign trail. Now, of course, we have reached this. I don't know. I want to call it a tipping point, but it's unclear whether it will be. The stories, though, of parents being separated from their children as they cross the border have obviously been heartbreaking, horrible. I think everyone spent the weekend glued to these stories and trying to figure out what to do. President Trump and administration officials are defending this so-called zero tolerance policy, the way that they are prosecuting existing law by separating families from their children. It is just one of a bunch of these changes in how the U.S. has been handling immigration. There is also news from last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions issuing a new policy saying that domestic violence and gang violence are no longer grounds for seeking asylum. That had been the argument that a huge wave of recent immigrants from Central America were making.
So we're going to talk to Kathleen Gasparian, as I said up top. She is an immigration attorney. She also teaches law at Loyola University in New Orleans. And she's going to help us understand how we got to where we are. And we're going to do a little history and then a little definition of terms and all kinds of good stuff. Anyway, Kathleen, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me. I really wish it was under better circumstances.
as do we. Mm-hmm. As do we.
You know, Kathleen, you'll see occasionally on Twitter someone say, look, Obama started the deportation wave that we're in today. We obviously know that President George Bush was trying to deal with immigration, trying to fix it. This is a guy from a border state. What are the factors that have led us to this point? What have been the policy failings all along?
From my point of really practical point of view, we get to where we are. It begins with a dramatic sweeping change in statutory law in 1996. So Republican-held Senate and House. President Clinton was in office, but it was a sweeping rewrite of how we do immigration. It set up all sort of like all the different paths. It also set up what we see now as really giving the Attorney General and the enforcement agencies lots of discretion. We made it much harder to get legal or get a legal status if you had ever violated your status in the past or if you'd ever been here without permission. And it also really set up a whole schematic by which the law says these are people who have to be held in detention no matter what. So that was in 96. And as we were then really getting into a real discussion of maybe immigration reform and what immigration should really look like, 9/11 happened. And that really cut off a lot of the discussion about immigration. And it really did dramatically change where we are. And of course, the other result of 9/11 was sort of the formation of the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. And so once we created DHS, everybody gets thrown under this umbrella and then it gets funded. Once it's DHS, it starts getting money. And so all of a sudden, the law that was in place that everybody kind of realized didn't really work. And all of a sudden now there's just tons and tons of money behind DHS. So we haven't had a big statutory change. But what we have seen is what we are learning under this administration as lawyers, immigration lawyers, is how much can the law change just by shifting policy, just by shifting priorities?
That's a really good point. Is there a way that if you had a crystal ball, you could have seen from immigration law changes in 96 and the establishment of DHS and the way things went in the 2000s, could you have seen that this was where we were going to wind up? Is this within the realm of possibility? Was it?
For me personally, no.
As a jaundiced viewer of the immigration law system, right?
No, actually, I think for me, the idea that is this one day what it always looks like? And yeah, sure, that always, as a practitioner, I guess you kind of think that's going to happen. But where I started really realizing these were possibilities began in 2014 when we started seeing large number of kids arriving at the southern border without guardians. And so you did have all of a sudden kids having to go through this system that is designed for adults and realistically really designed for adult males. And so kids having to go through this, and I really do mean kids, 5-year-old, 7-year-old, 12-year-old kids. And then you start realizing what that's going to look like. And then you realize other parts of the world are also dealing with these issues, and we have to. And you see images from other countries, and you go, "Oh well, but that's not here," except now it is, and it creates all sorts of questions, I think, for us how we want to be.
So when President Trump says the Democrats are to blame for this policy, is he
I mean, I don't know, I'm just trying to find a way.
Like, is there a possibility? Because we should be explicit and say that in 1996, Bill Clinton was president. And when this law was passed, in fact, and someone was, you know, it sounds like at least one immigrant was deported over a minor crime. Republicans wrote to the Clinton administration asking them to back down on how extreme this 96 law. Like, is there a possibility that that is what he's talking about?
So I don't know what he's talking about. But I think if you're saying it's the Democrats' fault, I think you either have to – it's either because the law was passed in 96 and so it was signed by Clinton, even though it was proposed by Republicans, Republican House, Republican Senate. Or you are – or the other, I think, piece of rhetoric that comes out of the administration is that somehow this is the fault of previous administrations because previous administrations – didn't apply the law in the same way. And so, yeah, the previous administrations didn't apply the law in the same way as it's being applied now, but it's the same law. And they did apply it. Everybody applied the law. The previous administration had the highest levels of removal to date up to this administration. But not all laws can be prosecuted on their plain language. I mean, speed limits are sort of like the perfect example. You have a speed limit. It's 35. The cops don't pull over everybody who's doing 36 or 37 miles an hour. They're going to pull over the person who's doing 55. Why? Well, part of it's just resources, but part of it is also just we're still rational, logical human beings. And even though a person maybe has a technical violation of the law, I came in without permission, but there are, you know, there's been factors that have softened that, right? I have a family, I have kids, I've been a member of my community for 20 years, all these different things that should somehow balance it out. And as rational prosecutors and lawmakers, you know, citizens, we make choices about not necessarily being black and white exactly about everything.
So what about the asylum changes and the kind of difference between the types of immigrants, economic versus asylum seekers, and Jeff Sessions' statement that he's going to kind of reverse this recent practice of allowing domestic violence and gang violence victims to ask for asylum. I mean, is that and also an interpretation of existing law? And can you talk to us about the differences between those sort of types of immigrants?
Sure. So when you look back historically over immigration law, the original founders came to the United States for exactly what asylum is about: freedom from persecution for religion, freedom from persecution, you know, for race, and all these different things. Our asylum law, as written, has been the statute itself is: if you can't go back because you think you're going to be harmed, right? You have a well-founded fear, so it's both subjectively, I'm afraid, and objectively, a reasonable person would be afraid. So I have a well-founded fear that I'm going to be harmed if I go back because of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a social group. Then, and you haven't committed a crime, and you haven't, you know, you can then get asylum in the United States. As written, that's really, really broad. And over time, people start, I think it's sort of case law has slowly narrowed down, well, what counts as persecution, and well, what counts as objective fear, and what counts as a political opinion, or what counts as a social group. And this is where the current dialogue is in, what counts as a social group. The Attorney General last week came out with Matter of AB, which says it's not rewriting asylum law. It's still sort of the basic sort of things, but what it does is it narrows down the circumstances in which domestic violence and certain types of gang violence claims can be looked at. And what it really – where it really will make an impact is as individuals are arriving at the border, they talk to an immigration officer and they say, I am afraid to go back. And if they have a credible fear, then they can get a full hearing in front of an immigration judge. And if you were narrowing down to the agency that's making these interviews and making these determinations of credible fear, if you are giving them a very narrow definition, then the numbers of individuals who are going to be able to demonstrate credible fear goes way down. And so essentially it'll just people just sort of start getting flipped, right? Because they're arriving at the border, they don't have access to counsel. They're not having an immigration lawyer explain to them this very complicated part. And it's just the officer sort of asking these questions. And they may not be answering with the nuance that's needed right. to now meet these exceptionally narrow interpretations.
So let's take it from there to now what? And let me throw a couple of stipulations mm-hmm. at her, and you can agree or disagree, counselor, as you see fit. stipulation number one is that our immigration system, everything from border security to how the laws are interpreted to how they're executed on the border, is completely boogered up. Is that fair?
Oh, yes.
Okay. stipulation number two.
I will agree with that.
Okay. Stipulation number two is that it will take both the legislative branch of the federal government and the executive branch of the federal government, and at some point in the distant future, the judicial branch of the executive of the federal government, to come to some solution. Right? Mm-hmm. You agree with that? Okay. So spitball it for me. How do we get from here to there?
I can do it in about 100 words, a couple zeros, and a bottle of whiteout, right? Yeah. But nobody's going to talk to me. Nobody's going to ask me to rewrite the Immigration and Nationality Act.
No, but you're but you're a practitioner. You're experienced right. in this. So what does the answer look like? What's if you could throw it together today, what does it look like?
Yeah, if they gave you the bottle of whiteout.
If they gave me the bottle of whiteout, yeah. So it begins with you have to move the immigration court out of the Department of Justice. You have to make the immigration court an Article I court. When you have immigration judges serving under the Attorney General in the same buildings with DHS, there is an image, an illusion that there is no due process. And what we have been seeing in terms of directives from Attorney General Sessions, in terms of the directives for how immigration judges should process cases, their case completion goals, all sorts of different things, we are rapidly careening to a court that is a farce.
Okay.
The second thing you do, you have to increase the number of temporary work visas. And you can easily tie it to the economy. When the economy's up, demand for those visas goes up. When unemployment's down, the demand for those visas go up. Because right now the channels for them are – there's so few available compared to the overall scheme. And you have a system in place for both not – what we call it non-immigrant. I'm calling temporary for a temporary time to do a temporary thing. And then the other thing I absolutely think you have to provide for is right now in removal proceedings, there is no court-appointed counsel, and so you can have an attorney, right? You can have an attorney, but there's no court-appointed counsel, and so you literally have children. Right. This was from a couple of years ago. You have, you know, a 3-year-old expected to defend themselves in immigration court. That's sort of the beginning for me. Right. Yeah. And then you just white out some little words here and there. But
if that's a beginning, I don't want to know what the end is. All right. Anyway,
that all sounds achievable once we get people talking. Kathleen Gasparian is an immigration attorney at Gasparian and Spivey. Thank you so much, Kathleen, for
Thanks
the time.
For your time.
Oh, my God, guys. It was such a great talk. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Thanks.
Wow.
All right. If you have further questions about immigration, we will do our best. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. But this is like, I was thinking about the Wilbur Ross thing, actually, as Kathleen was talking. And I was thinking, you know, okay, yes, apparently this is a case of this administration using existing law to its furthest possible conclusion,
yep.
Much like in the case of Wilbur Ross and his money, apparently, at least according to the National Review. These conflicts of interest appear to be entirely legal. Like, we don't have a system that anticipates way that someone will use it to its furthest extent.
The shocking thing is always that it's not what's illegal, it's what's legal. That's always the shocking thing.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep, exactly.
Paying the bills. Doing it. Bye.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Dear Make Me Smart.
This is Jess from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I'm David Stork of Portola Valley, California.
I'm a doctoral candidate.
I'm getting married this November.
I work for a Fortune 500 company.
All right. After Kai and I talked last week about the need for civil discourse, it led to lots more discourse, which was great. We also talked about radical love.
We did?
Yes. I was like, practice radical love. I'm obsessed with this idea of radical love. Some of you wrote back feeling the same way. Others, though, felt, you know, justified in their anger. But listener Brian Day tied it back to today's immigration conversation and left us this voice memo.
If we had had the courage to fight harder and louder before the election, then maybe I wouldn't be up tonight haunted by the story of United States government taking children of legal asylum seekers. I have a lot of respect for you and your opinions, even if we disagree. Thank you much.
So look, that's a fair comment, but let's point out that there was lots of fighting hard and loud before this election. I mean, there was lots of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the popular vote alone tells you that there was a lot of fighting.
A lot of fighting. Chris Durand has a slightly different immigration question. He notes how we talk about two different labor conditions that we've discussed on the show, that we need more immigrant labor in the country to maintain the workforce. Also, how automation is going to lead to mass unemployment. He says, and here's a quote, "If I'm correct about these two labor conditions, can you explain how both of these conditions can exist?" Off the top of my head, no, but we're going to take that one under advisement and talk about it at a future point because it's a valid point, right?
It is a valid point, although I will say off the top of my head, there's only so much that automation can do.
Like, let's hope they can't do this job. Just saying.
Yeah, well, yes. But no, it is very true. Like, when you talk about the type of jobs that automation can do, it is very possible that they could obviate the need for what we traditionally think of as the immigration workforce. But here in Silicon Valley, I would say that immigration workforce is very different than what you are probably thinking. Because we're talking about coders and entrepreneurs and startup founders and, it's not just will a machine, you know, pick crops, for example.
A way more nuanced answer than I gave. That is completely true.
Totally. And then finally, there were also, thank you all for the pretty good discourse about net neutrality in a Jeep Pie, because I know that's hard for folks. After that episode, many of you wrote follow-up questions and comments. Alex McKinley, though, asked, why was it necessary to repeal net neutrality in order to promote this expansion, presumably this innovation expansion or this expansion of broadband networks? Which is literally the question. That's the only question.
And he believes, as we talked about last week, he believes to the bottom of his bottom that that's what's going to get companies to invest. That's just what he says. I take him at his word. Travis Ritchie from Los Angeles left us this voice memo content. Starting that one all over again. Travis Ritchie, we should probably leave that in. Travis Ritchie from here in Los Angeles left us this voice memo about my talk with Ajit Pai. Here it is.
One of the things he said was, he says this over and over again, is, well, people are going to wake up on such and such a day and see that the internet hasn't changed. And no one expected to wake up on the day net neutrality was repealed and see the internet changed. What we are worried about, those of us who are concerned about net neutrality, is that the change will come over the coming years. And it will, as you guys have said, because businesses have an economic incentive to do the things that we're afraid they'll do.
That is totally true. That is my entire comment.
That is totally true. And also, one thing I should say, and several people wrote this in various forms, is, and this is true, is that even if you take Ajit Pai at his word that he believes a light touch regulatory framework is what will lead to broadband investment, he did go farther. He did go farther than just repealing Title II. He also got rid, you know, net neutrality was essentially an existing law of the land, and it got down to sort of enforcement. Mm-hmm. Sort of like the conversation we just said, how much it was or was not enforced. The FCC did the Title II thing to take sort of full control over that enforcement. And Ajit Pai went even farther than just repealing Title II. He also got rid of all the kind of existing protections on consumer protections and net neutrality protections. So I think that is part of – so there were a lot of sort of fact check emails on that point, and I want to acknowledge that as well, that it is – that is also very much in keeping – I think we can agree with this administration's approach to consumer protection, which is none whatsoever. Apparently none are needed, even though a third of the commercials that I see during all live sporting events are apology ads from companies who have done poorly by us. Nevertheless – protection is apparently not on the docket.
Just hit that outro music right now. That's all I'm saying. Apple Podcasts is where you can find us, or frankly, wherever you get your podcasts. But Apple Podcasts is the Google Play. We're also on like Stitcher and all kinds of other places. Now watch, we're not. I've said that, and we're not. You can find.
I know us, right? You made a terrible mistake.
Anyway, yeah. So leave us ratings and reviews. Tell us, friend, because you know we want people to hear what we do. Make Me Smart, produced by Shara Morris. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. We got him in the credits. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Woo-hoo. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was, somebody wrote in and corrected my grammar on this one, theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
Keep the emails coming. I can't believe how smart you all are. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Is.
For now, anyway. That's how I check to see if she's listening. Yeah, gotta listen all the way to the end, boss. And if you're not listening all the way to the end, sorry.
Sorry.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.